Hi, this is Ben.
I'm Zach.
And welcome to the Movie Vault. Today, we're reviewing one of the most important thing to ever come out in 1981. Or the most important thing to come out in 1989.
We're off onto a great start.
Yeah. I was going to make some sort of joke about Taylor Swift being born in 1989 and how this is way better than Taylor Swift.
Wow.
Okay. I really just am on a... I'm annoyed at Taylor Swift and Taylor Swift fans kind of... kick. So
okay, so your anger carried over into the podcast and you wanted to make a statement about
I messed it up, but it's okay because I still got my point across.
Okay, hopefully.
But anyway, today we're reviewing a triptych: Jim Jarmusch's Mystery Train. Jim Jarmusch is somebody that, if you know stuff about movies, you've probably heard of. Otherwise, you probably have never heard about him in your life. But he was actually born in Ohio, just found out, Cuyahoga Falls, which is pretty upper class area up in the Cleveland area, so maybe he came from some wealth. His father was of Czech and German descent and worked for the B.F. Goodrich Company. Now, I don't know why that's important, but but he was an avid reader and stuff, and he developed taste for the counterculture, yada yada. He moved to Chicago and studied at Northwestern before transferring to Columbia.
Wow.
And then he studied under avant-garde poet professors at Columbia, including Kenneth Cook. So he began to write semi-narrative abstract pieces.
That sounds about right.
Sounds accurate if you're used to watching Jarmusch's films. He graduated with a Bachelor of Arts from Columbia in 1975, and then he went to graduate school at New York University's School of Arts. NYU is, of course, known for having a great film program, especially in this era, I feel like, because he studied with people such as Sarah Driver, who I believe this movie was in memoriam to, and Spike Lee, who would be the most popular of all these people reference. So Spike Lee went to school with Jim Jarmusch. And so, of course, we were introduced to Jim Jarmusch earlier this year when Zach and I watched Stranger Than Paradise, which was a very low-budget film that was just...
Takes place in Cleveland.
It takes place in Cleveland in part of it. And it was... There's nothing really like it that I've seen.
No.
It's a deadpan comedy that describes it pretty well.
Yeah.
But it's just about these two guys who drive to Cleveland, meet this girl, and then they go to Florida, and that's pretty much it. Pretty much it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or was the girl was like the guy's cousin or something. It was a strange
unimportant
movie. Yeah. But yeah. So that's what there is to know. Jim Jarmusch, of course, he made Down by Law in 1986, which is a movie I've heard of but I've never seen, and then Mystery Train. And then most recently he did The Dead Don't Die, which had Bill Murray and Adam Driver in it. I recognize the poster, but I don't know whether it's any good. So he's sort of a face of indie. Oh, I guess he was married to Sarah Driver too. So that would be why the film was dedicated to her. I guess that makes sense.
Gotcha.
But this movie, as like we said, is a triptych. So there's three parts, and it's there's a couple from, I think, Japan. I'm pretty sure.
Yes.
Who come over to the U.S. and their whole goal is to see the city of Elvis Presley, the city of the king, Memphis. And that was really interesting to me because I never thought about anybody from another country really wanting to go to Memphis, Tennessee. But I guess it makes sense when you realize that Elvis was such a big deal.
And also in the context of Jarmusch's projects in Stranger Than Paradise, he's like, oh, Cleveland is such a great place.
Yeah. He's like, oh yeah, this is so good.
Yeah. So he kind of takes these boring places and says they're great. And you really do get fully immersed into it in all three narratives. And it's really a night, one night, this whole story takes place over. Three different people going to the same hotel where Screamin' Jay Hawkins runs the hotel. That's the actor's name. That's actually his name. So that's what he's credited as in the credits. So, but anyway, yeah, it's three stories, what is it?
Far from Yokohama.
A Ghost and Lost in Space.
Yep.
How would you describe Far from Yokohama?
It's a pretty simple story of them arriving in Memphis. The couple is Mitsuku and Jun. And they walk around Memphis, see the sights. They see Sun Records. Mm-hmm. And they see the one lady who's just like talking so fast in English and they can barely understand her. Mm-hmm. They have all these interactions with people. Their English isn't the best. And then they go to the hotel. And then there's the iconic scene where she lights a cigarette and with her feet and puts it in Jun's mouth, which is kind of odd. Mm-hmm. And that's basically that story. I don't know.
I mean, they make love and she puts lipstick on him and it has a few iconic things.
They do the lipstick thing. Yeah. It's hard to understand without the context.
Exactly. It's so hard to talk about because it really is just...
Honestly, does it even relate that much to the next two stories?
No.
It doesn't. It's just there, but it makes sense that it's there.
But we'll get into that. Thematically, yeah. I think it does. Even though there aren't really too many themes. But what would you say the second story, which is A Ghost, is like?
So it's about this Italian widow named Luisa, who's... We don't know why she's in Memphis. It says... On Wikipedia,
well, she's in there for a layover to Rome.
Or
yes. It got canceled or pushed or something.
And it says on the Wikipedia she's escorting her husband's coffin back to Italy, mm-hmm. which I didn't realize.
Yeah, that's like the first scene when you see her. She's in the airport signing documents with, and she says, "Is this your husband's coffin?"
Okay, that makes sense. But so she ends up walking back. She ends up buying a bunch of magazines and stuff. That happens, and then she talks to this guy. Well, the guy talks to her at this cafe in Memphis, and he tells this elaborate story about seeing the ghost of Elvis Presley while he was, and the ghost was hitchhiking back to Memphis, and then he asks her for money, and they're kind of bothering her a little bit. She has to get to the nearest hotel, which happens to be the same hotel that the couple from Yokohama is staying at. Mm-hmm. And we again interact with Screamin' Jay Hawkins and his compadre. And she gets a hotel room, but it's with another girl named Dee Dee, who is running away from her husband and doesn't have a lot of money and needs a place to stay. So she shares a room with Luisa. And then Luisa is just bombarded by Dee Dee's constant talking until she falls asleep. But then when she falls asleep, she sees the ghost of Elvis. This is one of the stranger parts of the entire movie. There's just this guy. I kind of wonder, is it the same actor who plays that guy they call Elvis in the third story? I didn't think about that until right now.
No.
It's not. Okay.
It's not.
It's just an Elvis impersonator, presumably. But it looks like actual Elvis. And so she wakes up Dee Dee, and Dee Dee is like, "I don't see anything. Why'd you wake me up?" And she's kind of annoyed. And that's that story. And they hear a gunshot. Actually, both the first two, they both hear a gunshot at the end.
Mm-hmm. So you know they're connected.
Yeah, they are connected because there's that gunshot.
And then in the third story, it kind of connects the three. What would you say Lost in Space is like?
Lost in Space is the more, adds a little bit more of action and a plot to the rest of the movie as it introduces characters who were referenced in the second story. Being Johnny, who they call Elvis, who Dee Dee is running away from, and then Dee Dee's brother Charlie, who is Johnny's brother-in-law, or so he thinks, and then we also meet Will Robinson, who is sort of why the name comes from Lost in Space, mm-hmm. because it's like Will Robinson is the main character on the show Lost in Space, and they have a couple conversations about this at different points. But essentially, Elvis and Will have gotten laid off. Elvis is at a bar with a bunch of other people who have been laid off. He's upset. He pulls a gun on someone in the bar. They call Will to come down and get him. Charlie comes too. They get him. They go to this liquor store. The clerk at the liquor store says something racist to Will. Something racist. Calls him the N-word. Yeah. And so a combination of probably wanting the liquor for free and being mad at the clerk he, Johnny kills the clerk, or shoots the clerk. I don't know that he kills him, but he shoots him. And so then they run away, and I guess they drink that alcohol, and they get, while they're driving, and they get drunk, and then they realize they need to stay somewhere, so they end up at the same hotel as everyone else, and they get a free room that's like decrepit because Will knows the people who own the hotel, and they make fun of him. What does he say? Danger, danger, Will Robinson. That was a great,
yeah,
great
line. He's kind of stupid, so it's a funny moment.
Yeah. And then they kind of drink themselves to sleep. And then when they wake up in the morning, Charlie learns that Johnny isn't his brother-in-law. They never actually got, Dee Dee and Johnny never got married. Dee Dee and Elvis, whatever you want to call him. And then Charlie's angry. Johnny tries to kill himself with the gun, and Charlie prevents him to, and then is accidentally shot in the leg. So Charlie gets the short end of the straw in this situation. And then they escape. We never see Louisa or Dee Dee again. No, we see Dee Dee. We never see Louisa. No, we see both of them. What am I saying? Now that I think about it, I just saw this. No, Dee Dee gets on the train with the people from Yokohama, and they're headed to Mississippi. And Louisa is in the airport running back to the airplane. And then the three amigos run away in the train, and Charlie looks miserable because his leg is shot, and they threw him in the back of the truck, and now they have to go all the way to Arkansas, which isn't that far, but it's far enough if your leg's shot.
Yeah, it's pretty far if you're shot. Yep.
So that's the movie. That's as simple as it is.
And it's fun because each of the stories are connected, because you have the bellhop who is kind of dumb. He's going up. He's taking up. He's expecting tips from everybody, and it's just really funny to see. Like he gets a plum from June, and what's her name again? He gets a plum from them, Mitsuku, from Japan, and then the Screaming Hey Jay Hawkins character just eats the whole plum at one point, and it's just hilarious. And it's a great, good connected film. And I want to first start off with this, because these were the thoughts that I was having, Ben. So after seeing Stranger Than Paradise, which is also one of his iconic films, and Jim Jarmusch doesn't have a ton of films out there, by the way.
No.
So this is really like one of his main
films.
These
three films, Stranger Than Paradise, Down by Law, and Mystery Train, I feel like are his defining movies. I've heard of Ghost Dog.
Okay.
So I don't know. I've heard of some of the other ones, but I feel like those three you kind of...
Yeah, those are his main three. How did you think it compared?
I thought that this one felt a little bit more like a movie.
It did.
Had a congruent thought that went throughout. Stranger Than Paradise felt like Jim Jarmusch wrote early in school is what that felt like.
Yeah, and I'm wondering why he took this direction, because this came out after The Stranger Than Paradise, and his previous films were all in black and white. I'm curious why he took the route of going not in vivid colors, but in plain colors, pretty dim. He portrayed Memphis, and I wonder why he needed to portray Memphis in that manner.
I think like the neon signs and the like different things like that were kind of important. The ghost of Elvis would have been hard to pull off in black and white.
Yeah.
So I think there's just some practicality, but also it tonally shifts the film a little bit too.
I agree. And I think really it doesn't matter if you portray Cleveland in black and white. To me, it's the same. It's funny because Memphis really is a ton of colors, and Elvis is really the center of this film.
Yeah.
If you think about it. Because, I mean, Memphis, Elvis, 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 at every corner you've gone. I just went to Memphis a couple months ago. Elvis, Elvis, Elvis at every turn. Graceland is there. It's mentioned here many times. The first couple wants to go to Graceland, and then the other stories, like the... what's the man that looks like Elvis? They just call him Elvis. He looks like Elvis, and she's running away. The woman in the second story, in a ghost, is running away from her husband, or so-called husband, not actually, apparently. They never actually got married, but they call him Elvis, and there is an Elvis picture in every single room. Just Elvis is all throughout this, and Elvis's ghost visits the woman, Louisa. So it's interesting that they centered it around this, but the term Mystery Train is actually based off of his song Mystery Train. And I know for people who have seen this movie, they probably know that, as it was played twice in this film. So There was actually a very, I think part of the reason he did it in color, Ben, is because he's relating it to modern day interpretation of old music, especially as, and I think he's doing some race stuff in there too. We can get into that. But I think he's doing a lot of like how cities like this that are built upon an industry of the past, or maybe even people of the past, how they've turned out. And it's really a big part of the film is like, he doesn't portray Memphis in a great light, you know? It's kind of like this dreary place. I think the color palette kind of displays that he's not a big fan, maybe. And he shows that, like, yeah, this is a black neighborhood where only black people really live, and it's like really bad for them. And he's trying to show that. And this takes place a while back. But some of the soundtrack, we'll focus on the music first. So Mystery Train is what it's based off of. It's Elvis Presley's song. It was released on August 20th, 1955. And it's based on a couple things. So it's based on an American folk music group called Worried Man Blues. It's the Carter family is the folk band. And it's actually, that is based on an old Celtic ballad, Ben. And it was all the way back in 1930. So the line, it's only three lines that are the main parts of the ballad. But it's, the train arrived 16 coaches long. The train arrived 16 coaches long. The girl I love is on that train and gone. And then it says, train I ride 16 coaches long. Train I ride 16 coaches long. Well, that long black train carries my baby home. So I don't know if Jim was particularly trying to do a big story like this, but I also think he was, because that last line, well, that long black train carries my baby home, is for the first story. The second story is the man's wife who's running away, the wife who's running away from, or I guess girlfriend that's running away from the character of Elvis, is the girl I love is on that train and gone. So I think that's why he's doing that. And it's, I don't know if there's anything deeper that goes on to that. That's not much content to work off of. But some other songs that are in there are Blue Moon. It's played a lot because all three sets of stories have the radio on, apparently. And apparently it's pretty popular at 2 a.m, whatever this time is. So that's by Richard Rodgers. Domino is played by Roy Orbison. The Memphis Train, that fits the story pretty well. Get Your Money Where You Spend Your Time, Pain in My Heart, and Soulfinger. Those are also slightly played, not that much. But really, Mystery Train is what it's based off of, because I think of that line specifically. What did you think? How do you think you actually said this while we were watching it. You said, I like it when directors make their story intertwined with the music.
Yeah. So I don't know what, there's probably a name for this technique, but essentially all it is you play a song, and then instead of cutting the song when you shift the scene, the song continues to play in a different format in a different location. So like the song will be playing with in the truck with these characters, and then the scene will cut visually, but the song will still be playing at the hotel on the radio there.
You like the transition.
And it's like they're listening to the same.
Do you get chills when transitions like that happen? You're like, whoa.
Not chills, but I'm like, I like the cohesiveness of it. And I said, I just watched American Graffiti, and it, like, they use that the entire film to go from car to car, because the whole movie is just like this. It's one night, so it maybe works better. And what Reservoir Dogs also uses this. So like all these movies happen in a like limited period of time where it makes sense that people are listening to the same
two
music.
Two of the three have Steve Buscemi.
Yeah, true. So maybe if you want to use this style, you got to think about casting Steve Buscemi as well.
Yes. What do you think what do you think centering the movie about music adds to it? Or a particular song?
Or a particular song. Well, I don't know what it adds to it, but with this movie, it's like the movie would not exist without, like, it's like the idea came from the song.
Yeah, but why does that make it a good film? I don't know why.
Well, I don't know whether it makes it a good film.
Comparing to others. Did you like this film?
I liked this a lot.
Okay.
But when you watch something like this, it's hard to put into words exactly why you like it. Because it's like, it's kind of just an evocative movie. It just evokes feelings. It seems like more base level than other movies.
Yeah, but I think,
because it doesn't have like a huge ascending arc, and then
the plot isn't very the forefront. No. Let me break this down. Let me see what you're trying to say. I want to know if this is true. Do you think it's because at the heart of it, when a movie has stories, or not stories, music intertwined into the themes of the film, do you think that adds like not only like you have to search for the answers and kind of look what you're like, look for something within the film, because this, for some, a common moviegoer, this is nonsense. This doesn't make any sense. Like, this is just a video camera on someone. It's not a video camera, but like, you're just watching people go throughout their days. There's no story. But I think you can see a few different things going on, especially with the Mystery Train concept in the song. I think what it adds to it is like, it kind of, I know this is going to sound really cheesy and dumb, but it like makes it a part of history, you know? It kind of like brings back a theme from a historical thing, and it brings it in.
It adds more layers to the song itself too. Okay, because instead of it just being a song that has words, now you see it visually played out a little bit. Because I wouldn't have thought of that necessarily until you dissected the lyrics of Mystery Train, and then you realize that he made decisions specifically in relation to the lyrics and built upon them. And then it's like, it's referential too, because it's like, how has Elvis influenced all of these people, and now they're going back, and and like, some people are annoyed at Elvis. Like, you get to see all of these different like kind of reactions to an icon of history and of music history.
Yeah.
And you get to be in a place, like, it immerses you in a location, a city.
That was my next point. I think the reason that you like it is because of the immersion. That's the only way that you can feel things in a movie, is if you feel immersed. If you feel like you're there. If you feel disconnected from a movie, that's the opposite of immersion. You're not going to feel any emotions if you're disconnected, right?
Right, because you wouldn't care about the characters at all. It doesn't mean anything what they do.
The only way to get any emotion from this film whatsoever is to be immersed, right?
Yeah.
Without a plot structure, the only way is immersion. So how did this film do it well?
The framing of, and the dialogue was so, it doesn't necessarily put you in something that you're like, this feels like real life, but it immerses you in a world that is Jim Jarmusch's. This is what happens with directors like Wes, I wouldn't say Wes Anderson, because he uses other things too, but they put you in their world. So like, the way that the characters act makes sense within the world.
You could say Wes Anderson. They're all pretty cold.
Yeah. Like, he adds other flashy things that I think maybe distract from always seeing that. But in this world, people act in the way that Jim Jarmusch wants them to. So like, the person that it kind of reminded me of in the way that the characters talk to each other was David Lynch.
Okay.
Now, David Lynch adds all sorts of like, dreaminess and other things, but in that actual, I'm a person, or there's a character talking to another character, it just felt like it's colder, more blunt kind of dialogue than you would maybe expect. But there's still like jokes and stuff and things, but it just feels different than real life. But it also feels like a world that's not necessarily cinematic in the sense that we normally think of it.
Oh, great. Yeah, you're right. I think the more he got into the realness of life, the more cinematic it became.
Yeah.
I think like that shot of the train could be overlooked in any TV show or movie, right? It's just a train. It's a transition shot, right?
Yeah.
You put it in there. But he showed it, that shot of that train, over and over and over. And it was like part of the theme of the film is the train. And I think that that shot was much more beautiful. It wasn't like spectacular. It wasn't like, it wasn't like perfectly framed. And it wasn't like the sun was setting at that time. It was just like a night in Memphis. But it has so much more meaning, and I think that adds to the visuals. And I think you're right. And the colors were very mute. A few reds stuck out. So I thought to myself, like, at the bar, there was some red. There was some red that stuck out. The lipstick was red that stuck out, and then the Screaming Jay Hawkins shirt stuck out. Louisa's, was she wearing red or no? I can't remember. I just remember red just being pretty apparent throughout the film. And I don't think that has any connotation. I just think he chose that. I just think it works well. But another thing, I think the best part of the immersion experience in this film was just conversation after conversation. And they weren't even like full-blown conversations. It could have been like 10 minutes of walking and like just going through the city with some background. Mainly no background music. That does help with immersion, by the way.
Yeah.
And there was a few, when they're walking down the Memphis street.
Boom, boom, boom.
Exactly.
Boom, boom. That's what made me think of David Lynch, too. Because that riff sounded so much like a David Lynch movie.
It did.
And they are from sort of the same time period, so it's like possible that like it's kind of like I don't know. Well, just a coincidence.
That it's funny that you keep bringing David Lynch back, because I thought exactly that where Elvis's ghost comes up. Yeah. I thought like that's a David Lynch thing to do.
Yeah.
It reminded me of Twin Peaks. It reminded me of the season 2, episode 1 episode where that guy, that tall random guy just comes up and then disappears and has a chapter of conversation. I don't know
that I've seen that. Oh, wait, maybe I have. Was that in the like very first
scene? Yeah, I don't want to spoil it. It's after a character has been shot and it's just like, yeah. He's just there. It just reminded me of that. It's just like so random. It doesn't make any sense, but it's part of the plot. Like it's pretty directly related. But yeah, those were the only scores in the film, right? Just that one thing, and it was reused 2 or 3 times.
Yeah.
And also the cool thing was there was a little bit of order in the film, despite the postmodern take on storytelling. There was a little bit of order. Everybody was surprised that there was no TV in the in their room. Everyone had something to say about Elvis. You know, everybody had their different take on the circumstances that they were in, and everybody went to the hotel. So there was some cohesive structure by the nature of the actual, was it typic? I forget. But yeah, or triptych.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Triptych.
That just shows, I just ruined it because you said it at the beginning as if we knew it, and then now I just ruined it, and it's like.
We didn't know anything about what a triptych was until this. We saw the Wikipedia article for this.
I ruined it. But that the order of that just, it adds order. And I think it's just so different from Stranger Than Paradise, but his style is still there. And his style really is just like, let's just see what happens almost.
Yeah. But I feel like, so I'm just like breezing through how he did the casting for this movie. And I feel like this adds even another layer. So the guy who played Johnny, who is British, by the way, which is odd, he is not just anybody. He is Joe Strummer, who was the frontman for the punk band The Clash.
Oh, really?
Know? Should I Stay or Should I Go? Those songs.
Seriously?
Yeah.
Why would he cast him? That's so
because
weird.
It was Jarmusch's favorite band. So he just gets the lead singer of The Clash in his movie.
Okay.
And so I'm like, okay, so he had to make him British because he wanted this guy in his movie, and he cast him for this part. So he had to be British. So that's one random thing.
Oh, that's a great move right
and
there.
And then we already noticed Screamin' Jay Hawkins was in it. He didn't know Screamin' Jay Hawkins until after Stranger Than Paradise.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So they got in touch after that?
They got in touch after, and he was like, okay, I'll do it. And well, then,
for those that don't know, Screamin' Jay Hawkins was... one of his songs was featured in Stranger Than Paradise, and then I guess after that they met, and then now he was in this film as an actor, which is crazy. That's awesome.
And his song, none of his music was used in it. He was just an actor.
Okay.
Then the bellboy was Sinke Lee, who is Spike Lee's younger brother.
No way.
Yeah. So it's just crazy. And then Robbie Mueller, who is the cinematographer, he is, I don't know how he met him, but he is known for working with Wim Wenders, who is a German, and I'm assuming Robbie Mueller is also German.
Did I read something that he was on Stranger Than Paradise as well?
He could have been,
but
that, and then singer Tom Waits, who's a relatively famous singer, was the DJ throughout. So,
oh, interesting. Okay, yeah, quite a cast that is not really well known, but has weird connections. You know,
no, I say they're not. None of them. A lot of them are well known. But none of them are well known as actors. Like,
they're not known for their faces.
No.
No.
No, definitely not. Other than Steve Buscemi. Buscemi is the most recognizable person in this whole movie.
And he's the best in this film, probably.
Yeah. He's great. He's perfect for the role. This had to have been pretty early in his acting career.
Any role that Steve Buscemi has, he kills it because he always plays the character that's the most stressed out. And he like starts having freak outs and like cursing people out here left and right. And like he never handles the stress well, any of his characters. And it's awesome.
You see some Mr. Pink in here.
Yeah, he has a type. He doesn't go for like the leader or the strong guy. I mean, you can't cast him as that. You really can't. He's like this almost, this sounds bad. It's almost this rat-like figure that kind of, he reminds me of Michael Cera maybe. Maybe Michael Cera will be a Steve Buscemi.
And it's become more as he got older because like those features stand out even more than when he was younger, I think.
But he kills it in those roles because it's like he's so niche of an actor that those roles were kind of made for him. It's not like he... Yeah, it's not like those roles exist.
All the movies that he was in, several Coen Brothers movies and... Yeah, I mean...
Monsters, Inc.
Steve Buscemi. I think... Yeah, they do this thing on the rewatchables where they ask like whether these certain actors would make a movie better, and Steve Buscemi is one of them. They have, there's like three. I don't really know the other two that well.
Oh,
but okay. Steve Buscemi, I'm like, pretty much any movie would be better with Steve Buscemi.
That's so funny. We said that too, I think.
Yeah.
That's so funny. Not that we're, like, I'm not trying to, like, puff my chest to the rewatchables. I'm just, you know. But anyway, so this film was actually nominated for the Palme d'Or at, at Cannes.
At Cannes.
And it wasn't, I don't think it won. But that's really big. That's like, Jim Jarmusch is actually very famous in the film world. He's just not as prevalent today or relevant today because I don't think he's done much lately.
I think
is he alive?
There's a references, he is alive, I'm pretty sure. But it references that at some point the critics became a little bit more critical of his work especially after Mystery Train.
Okay.
So I don't exactly know why that is, but yeah, I can say some of these movies, like, I've heard of The Dead Don't Die, but I don't know that it was, like, amazingly critically received mixed reviews. So it's kind of like either he just hit his creative peak, or maybe it's like he can only do so many of his style before people got a little tired of it.
I feel like people took his style, and I don't know if made it better. People have stolen his style and added their own little nuances to it. I think of Nomadland, where you have this character who's kind of just going through life, no real story, but it's like trying to give a message. And I think people go for that a little bit more. People connect with that. And I think that's what the industry has kind of pushed forward and kind of left Jarmusch's style a little behind.
Yeah. The thing I do like about Jarmusch, though, is like his films do kind of have this like under layer of like crime, though. Like,
what do you mean?
So in Stranger Than Paradise, they like, don't they like rob something? They do some sort of scheme where they're like stealing something.
Yeah.
And then it's like at towards the end of the movie. And then here it's like they shoot the guy.
Oh,
so
yeah,
it's like,
fair.
It's like more subtle than like Tarantino or something where they like use crime as like the crux of, but like he always has this like under layer of like, oh, nobody, they do some sort of criminal action.
Nobody gets in trouble.
So it's sort of a crime movie in some ways. Yeah, nobody ever gets caught in this movie so far. Yeah. So,
but yeah, it is interesting because he is well connected in Hollywood.
It seems like people like him.
Yeah,
like there's like people who are like Jim Jarmusch, like he's one of those guys who has like friends and they are all in his movie or whatever.
But he really is a different kind of director. You have to think, because you have to think of the directors that have been prevalent and relevant today. I use both of those words twice already, and I think it's those directors came up out of pure wit, whereas this guy has been trained. He's been trained in the film industry. You know what I mean? He went through all the schooling. He went to these great universities. Whereas other directors, I think of the big nine directors of our generation right now really are just kind of coming out of a script that was taken up by some random person at some random time, and they got kind of lucky or had some great connection. And there are a ton of great directors that have come from universities, but he really is in that university. I wonder if they would consider him almost a preppy director. I don't know, because he really does have some great. He went to Columbia and NYU, so it's like this guy went through all that training to make this. You know what I mean? And he kind of invented this his own style, which is great, and I think that's awesome. But I'm wondering if he was taught that in those universities. Probably not. He was probably taught cinematography and stuff like that. But when he was going through that school, he was taught probably more standardized structures and models of filmmaking.
Yeah.
At the time. But like, I'm really glad he made this, and I'm glad that people have taken off with it. Because really, filmmakers, I bet tons of people don't understand that. Although he hasn't had a huge, earthquake on Hollywood, he hasn't changed the world in that way. He really has added a nuance to it in a way that like, the plot isn't as in the forefront as it is in many movies as it was before him.
Yeah.
So, and even like you think of like, there's this postmodern push that Jarmusch and Quentin Tarantino were at fault for, but Jarmusch is less plot. Quentin Tarantino is a ton of plot, right? So it's like you can go postmodern in either direction. You can have more plot, less plot. Jim Jarmusch isn't even character driven. He's not. I don't know what driven besides immersion, which is great. And I think he's really like pushed everything down so that he can take the immersivity up. Because really, that's how life is. I don't get to understand your character. I kind of just understand you through how I perceive you. So,
I think it's like there must be this internal desire for some artists to be like, I want to see how much I can pull out of the mundane. Like, I sometimes think that with these kind of art directors, because it's like, it's not stimulating enough for them to like do something that's fantastical. But like, in a sense, he is doing something fantastical. He does use the ghost of Elvis. He does some like interesting things, but he like, he wants so much for like, it's not about making life more exciting than it actually is.
That's kind of what I was saying earlier. I was like, that shot of the train isn't because it's spectacular. It's because it feels real.
Yeah.
Because you're immersed in it. I'm going to say the word immersed so many times.
But then the criticism to that for, you know, the layperson who's not a film critic would be like, well, why so can't
there,
you just... In
Ben's mind, there are film critics and then there are laymen.
Laymen, yeah. Regular people who go watch movies who aren't film critics.
There are, I mean, no others.
The only thing that qualifies me as a film critic is that I bought a microphone, but... but, you know, they would say, oh, you could just go, you know, sit on a bench and see real life, or, you know, but not necessarily like this. I mean, it's not exactly real life. Like, there's still a cinematic quality to it. Like, things wouldn't go exactly like this. But, and the way the music intertwines.
I'd say maybe that's like, I don't know.
I mean, you're not walking down the street here and
I know.
Boom, 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 but you could have your AirPods in. So, I don't know.
True, nowadays. It's just, he's just doing things. That's what I'm saying. I wouldn't call anything he did in this film cinematic at all. Maybe like that one shot of them with
the lipstick or on the train. Well, like some of the shots, I think.
Some of them, but like it's really not, to me, it's not like the cinematography was good, but I don't feel like the story or the film at all was cinematic. I categorize those as separate.
Like in comparison to our, to Jaws, which we just recorded earlier today.
Yeah.
It's like kind of the polar opposite.
There's drama. That's what I think. Like drama, drive even. There's no drive in this. You know, I think of like when someone says, my life is so cinematic, it's because there's some driving force in their life doing, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And in this, there's nothing. Besides the fact that you know this is going to cross over somehow. That's the driving force, is your expectations. It's not the story itself.
And then the little bit of excitement at the end when they shoot the guy.
Yeah, and that was awesome. He's like, excuse me.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that these kinds of movies exist, though, I think. I think there's like, it would be hard to be like, oh, I'm going to watch this type of movie all the time. Like, I don't think that's the type of person I am. Maybe there is a person out there who's like that. But it is, from time to time, it does, like, it allows you to see more the broader world of things that you could possibly do. And I'm sure people have drawn out ideas from this and then, like you said, added other things, added their own nuances to some of the style that Jarmusch picked. So it's like, I think that's why people revere some of these art directors so much. Mm-hmm. It's maybe not because they're like, oh, this is the movie I would love to watch all the time, but because of how, you know, without this person making a base level idea, some people would never think to do some of the stuff that Jarmusch does.
Yeah, and I wouldn't call this a rewatchable.
No.
And that's not a problem at all. This is great within itself. I'd say my favorite aspect of the film wasn't the connectedness. I would say that kind of somewhat, all the connections were fun to point out, but it kind of, I have a little fatigue because of films these days, you know.
They love connected. The connection things.
But this was before, so I wouldn't have had that fatigue before.
They also are fairly obvious connections when you realize. Yeah. So it's not like somebody making a 2-hour long theory video on why this connection was, why this happened and why it's referencing the next movie, you know. Yeah,
and these connections actually had somewhat of a meaning, which is great. Whereas some connections are just to service, fan service.
Yeah.
So this was great because we're not fans of these characters
yet. Yeah, no.
These are IPs. It's just, I really liked it. I liked the relationship between June and the girl, just like how quiet he was and just like, I am happy. You know, he's just like saying that he was happy, but he was clearly just not smiling at all. And then just like, she's like trying to cheer him up and stuff, and he's like, I was happy before, like, you didn't need to do that. It's just like, he's awesome. But then the second story was fun. That woman Luisa is great. That guy I was really uncomfortable that whole conversation of the Elvis
stuff.
Yeah,
that was so weird.
That woman was great.
How about Charlie the barber?
Yeah,
it was awesome. Forgot that he was a barber. They had like a 2-minute scene with him cutting hair.
Yeah, that was great. And it's just fun. I'm glad that Jarmusch, at least I've only seen Stranger Than Paradise in this. I'm really limited in what he does, but those are like his forefront films, at least. They are very contained, and I'm very happy for that, because you could have easily added so much more into this film. It's like almost 2 hours, and he really stretches out
a
few things.
That's definitely true. He could have turned this into some sort of crime thriller, really. Mm. With the people running away, you know, they could have done a lot of different things with these characters, but there was a reason he chose not to do that. So that's kind of interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. So funny thing about Jim is apparently he had gray hair at a very young age.
Yeah. They were saying that Tom Waits was saying that affected his perception of the world. I guess I didn't have gray hair at 15, so I wouldn't know.
Yeah. But he's had famous actors in all of his films. You know, this one's probably a little bit less, but Steve is a good one. He's had Johnny Depp. He's in Dead Man. It's just lots of great ones. So I need to get more into it. I haven't. He's a director that this is what I think. If you want to test if someone actually really likes movies and has a passion for it, ask if they know who Jim Jarmusch is. Most people will say no, it's okay. I'm not saying I'm special because I know who he is. Somehow I found out about him.
Yeah.
But you'll get to a point where you'll see his movies. Because I've seen these movies referenced all the time. All the time. Like, people talk about his influence in different areas specifically. But it only happens if you get past the Scorsese and the Anderson and the...
Nolan.
Yeah. Yeah. It only happens if you get past...
There's levels. There's level one... Level zero is, I really don't care that much about movies, so I'll kind of just watch whatever is... And that's okay. There's a lot of people who are in level zero, and they're perfectly content there. They don't have to ever get to any of the other levels. Level one is sort of like, there's usually a couple of different directions, but usually nowadays people get in through Christopher Nolan, I feel like.
Yeah.
And then they get really into Christopher Nolan movies, and they're like, he's the best, you know, and they love all of the math equations and stuff that come with his movies.
Listen, this is what I'll say. I'm not trying to be like rude to anyone. Seriously. I love Christopher Nolan.
He's great. He's great. He's amazing.
But I'm going to use a bad example of one of his movies. If someone says their favorite movie is Inception, they, in their mind, they're saying, I know movies really well.
Yeah.
This is the best movie that exists. And by the way, 50% of the population says this, that Inception is their favorite film. Then I just clearly know, like, no, not at all. And I'm sorry. That's just how it is.
Yeah, it is.
And it's a great movie. It really is awesome. It's awesome.
Yeah. You could probably put – we always reference Scorsese and Tarantino, so I tend to think they're level one kind of.
Oh, they're level one.
Because Tarantino was somebody that I was watching when I was first getting into movies.
Everybody
knows. He's probably one of the first directors I watched, like, all of his movies, or, like, watched a bunch of them. So, you know, maybe I came in through the Tarantino route more than the other people.
Yeah.
But, and then level two is, then it starts getting, like, more obscure. So, level two is, like, David Lynch, I would say. Like,
okay.
Because people know David Lynch, but he's not quite as well known as the other guys.
Okay. Would you say Jim's a level two or three?
He's, like, three.
I'd say a three.
He's three.
Because he doesn't have too much. He doesn't
three have too much might be where you start putting in, like, foreign directors who are famous. Like, okay. Just because we're in the
U.S. Kurosawa? What do you put him?
Kurosawa would probably be level three.
He's not a four. He's level three. Western society.
He's level three, possibly level two, but it's kind of how you look at it.
I'd put him at a global scale. I'd put him at a two.
Yeah,
he's if you're talking about America, he might be a three.
Because like, I would put Ingmar Bergman as level two, but like since we're in the U.S., it's like different. Feels like level three.
It is different here because this is where Hollywood is.
Yeah, so nobody knows like Ingmar Bergman or like who Jean-Luc Godard,
Sergio Leone.
Sergio Leone.
I'd say he's a two or three. He's
two or three.
I'd say he's a two outside of the U.S. Everybody in the U.S. automatically goes down a level.
Yeah.
Apparently.
Yeah. And then level four would be like more obscure foreign directors.
Yeah. What about Bernie Rao?
Bernie Rao is like level seven.
I mean, that's awesome.
Because level seven, you start to like purposefully... kind of bad and cheesy movies that are like self-aware.
Not that his movies are bad.
They're not like, bad. That's what I'm saying.
It's like he
knows what he's doing and he's working with what he's got.
Yeah.
So they're I don't think they're bad. I think once you understand them, they're actually kind of good.
Yeah, and obviously the levels also correlate with financial success because that's how you get your name out there. But yeah, I'd say so too. I'd say I went in through the Wes Anderson route because I watched most of his movies except for like the three that I just finished out.
Yeah, he would be a level one.
He's definitely guy that
people
one.
Get yeah. into.
Yeah, yeah. If your films are being shown in commercials and like their posters at the theater, then you're a level
or one. Or your like name, people use your name as synonymous with a style of movie,
yeah, fair enough.
Like, then you're probably level one.
If someone who says that if their favorite film is Inception has seen Wes Anderson films as well, then yeah.
Now it's like I'm trying to think of like the most obscure director that I've seen that is like actually notable, because there's some movies that are obscure, but like who directed them is kind of inconsequential.
Yeah.
So it's Cronenberg would probably be level two. Some of these just then you start getting.
I put Cronenberg as a one.
One. Cronenberg's yeah, you're right. Cronenberg is like people say things are Cronenbergian. Yeah. You know.
And now I put like Ridley Scott up there. Spielberg's obviously Spielberg's Fincher, level zero. Fincher, Spielberg is like,
John Hughes.
Someone who's never seen a movie knows who Spielberg is.
Yes, he's level zero. Yeah, yeah, definitely.
So,
Paul Thomas Anderson's level one, probably.
Yep, probably.
Yeah. So maybe we'll come up with our best level three directors at some point. But I probably have to.
We haven't seen that many movies. Make a list of this. That would be fun.
Maybe we should.
Yeah,
how to get into movies? We should just make people a path of how to get.
And it's a choose your own path.
It's choose your own. So okay. Like, if you like this person, you go to this person.
Yeah,
that'd be kind of interesting.
That would be really hard to make.
Yeah, I'm not sure whether I'm really qualified to make that, but
We could do the first few levels.
Yeah, and then you just keep adding to it.
Yeah,
it might actually that might make it because of my more analytical side. I would be like, oh, that's how I choose how to. Yeah. How to watch a new director. You go on the level down from the last guy that you liked.
Yeah. The movie vault method. That's what we call it. MDM.
MDM.
Yeah. But yeah, I think... What was your favorite of the three?
Third one.
Because of yeah. Steve.
Because of Steve.
Okay.
I think I just... It hooked me the most.
Yeah. I'd say mine's the first. I think the relationship was funny to me.
That is good. All of them are good. I think the second one... is the weakest overall to me.
Yeah.
It feels like the least amount happened, but
less character interaction. Yeah. She's kind of just going about trying to avoid people.
Yeah.
So
I definitely think the one and three are the best.
Yeah. So, and she obviously got a lot of money from life insurance. She's the only one who takes a plane at the end.
And she's just like handing out money. Like it's, yeah.
She's M&M's. Like, take 200, take it. and yet she picked that hotel. I know that those guys were kind of coming after her, but she, I'm sure there's a better area. And that's her own fault. Why is she there at the diner?
Why'd she just randomly start walking around from the hotel?
I'm just saying.
There was not a hotel closer to the airport.
I'm just saying. Yeah, it's weird. So,
I mean, I don't know the geography of Memphis, but yeah, it was strange.
Yeah. So, yeah, Elvis, thank you for this masterpiece. Without Elvis, we wouldn't have this.
Yeah, if no Elvis, there's no... So, I guess... You know, I'm not the biggest Elvis fan, but...
No. Blue Moon was really good. I listened to it after.
Yeah, so. Blue Moon's good. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's just because I haven't really... That's hard to get into Elvis because I feel like back then it was all about the singles.
Yeah.
There's no album to listen to. It's just like Elvis songs.
Yeah.
That's not the way I think about music. But the vinyl records could only have so much, so, you know.
Yeah.
That's how it worked.
Sure. Yeah. That leads into we're doing, hopefully soon,
Top 10 albums. Top
10 albums. So yeah, outside the vault. So that'll be stay tuned for that.
Yes,
that'll be exciting.
Yeah,
I haven't finished formulating my list yet. We'll see if it's good.
Mine's always being updated. I always have a list, but
okay.
I think I'm happy with my recent update so far.
After knowing you for so much time, I already know where so if like a few of them in your top 10.
Maybe I've switched it up a little bit, but I don't know.
Have drastically changed.
Yeah. It's possible.
I think so.
It's too hard. I keep trying to come up with like a top 100, but it gets way too hard because it's like, how do you?
I'm gonna write down my guesses for you too.
That would be funny.
That'd be funny. Yeah.
I know you're like top three, but I'm not sure.
I never said
no. You're my like top four, three. Actually. Maybe.
You know my top artists. You don't know my top albums.
Oh, that's a good point. I don't know your top albums. Yeah. I talk about mine a lot obnoxiously, so it's kind of hard for people to miss.
Well. But yeah, I hope to watch more Jim Jarmusch films. Honestly, this one, do you think it was better than Stranger Than Paradise?
Yeah, it was better.
Really? Okay.
I think it was. I think, really?
I don't know.
I'm surprised by that.
I don't know.
I just think I get, because it, like I said, it evokes more feeling. So I think that's what I like about it.
Yeah, I don't know. It's not just because it was in our hometown. By that, I mean the state of Ohio. I think it's because the black and white added... And it's just like three characters the entire movie.
Yeah, it's so
simple. You get to know them really well.
Yeah, true.
Whereas the time is split in this. So I think I like Stranger Than Paradise slightly better, but they're both very good and their style carries over. But there are clear directorial differences in either, in each one. And Screamin' Jay Hawkins, he's the best. I listened to every single one of Screamin' Jay Hawkins' songs after Stranger Than Paradise, like last year. It was amazing.
Yeah.
So I'm going to listen to all of those again.
That's funny.
Yep.
Screamin' Jay Hawkins.
Yep. Thank you, Jim. I appreciate it. You did this to me. So.
All right. You ready to close this thing up?
I am. What do you want to do to close?
If we need a train.
Wait, plug our socials.
Oh, yeah. We got to remember to do that. At the Movie Vault Pod on Instagram. At Movie Vault Pod on Twitter. Although we don't really update our Twitter, but still follow it. We might if we get more followers. And then.
If we get just one.
If we just get one follower.
I've never seen it. Do we have any?
We have a couple.
Okay.
And then. Anna used to run it, remember?
Oh, yeah. We still owe Anna a prize for our Infinity War Endgame. We had, like, at the end of the almost 4 hours, there was, like, won the prize. We need to get her one.
Yeah. And then, what's the other thing we have? Oh, themovievaultpod@gmail.com.
Yeah.
And then we are sponsored by Hedman Anglin Agency. And I do not have their phone. Do you have their phone number?
614-486-7300. That's 614-486-7300. Please
call auto them to get a quote. Home business.
Yeah.
Anything? Call them for a quote.
Yeah.
They want to save you money.
Yeah.
So that's the important part to know.
They do. And especially in these times when the insurance market is changing, you really need to get a good quote from a good guy.
Yeah.
And there are a few good guys there.
Yeah.
No, and not because most of them are bad. It's because they're like a very small business, which is really good. That means you get the personal touch.
Right. Right. You wouldn't get that from the big insurance agents.
They're all of them. There are good guys. I just want to be clear. Okay. With my statement.
Yeah.
Okay? I'm not trying to lose our sponsorship.
Right.
3 years in.
Yeah. That would not be great.
Yeah.
All right.
But after this
Barbenheimer,
did that already come out?
We already put that should one? Have already come out.
So then next would be, what is it called?
Inland Empire.
Okay.
Well, so we'll see then. Watch Inland Empire. I don't know what it's about. It's a David Lynch movie who we've referenced on this episode. So now we'll probably reference Jim Jarmusch on the episode about David Lynch. That reminded me so much of Jim Jarmusch when this happened.
Like, it really is a good filler.
I think a good test for me would be to try to watch a movie without referencing Quentin Tarantino. Like, I feel like I reference him, and, like, I don't even mean to. I just
do we lose credibility when we reference him?
That's what I feel like, because he's a level one director.
Yeah.
And I keep bringing him up, like, and like I said, I don't even mean to, and it's not even that close to, like, his style.
The other thing it's because we compare him in, like, as an opposite.
Yeah, that's true.
And also, like, we're trying to make it relatable. Maybe we should be less relatable.
Yeah, maybe we should try to make this harder to understand.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But anyway. Okay. Well, I'll close the vault. Do the David Lynch sounding, like the sound, the score.
Boom, boom, boom. I kind of forgot it. Boom, 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 boom. Something like that.